Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. Speaking of movie love, what a special show we have for you this week. My name is Patrick Bromley, and this is our Valentine's Day episode of F This Movie, chock full of love and movie love. And so I am joined, of course, by the greatest lover I know, JB.
I'm lucky in love.
I love you, JB.
I love you too, Patrick.
This is our alternative Valentine's Day episode, so we will not be talking about traditional Valentine's Day movies or traditional romances.
Yes, there are plenty of those, and when I went searching on the Google machine for something offbeat, I noticed the same 10 titles kept cropping up again and again for the offbeat. So, as we've discussed, there are not many good romantic comedies. There aren't many good romantic movies either. And so we're talking about a subgenre of the best of a very limited genre.
Yes. And even I feel like within certain subgenres looking for ideas, I still kept finding the same 10 movies.
Yeah. It's odd.
Yeah. Maybe it's just the internet.
I was surprised by some of the titles that kept coming up again and again and again.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're going to be talking about that in just a few minutes, so you can celebrate your Valentine's Day with us. But first, J Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, yes and no.
All right.
I've been catching up. I think so few great things are released in January, because maybe Hollywood realizes the middle of the country's catching up on the December awards films. But because the pickings in January were slim. I saw Den of Thieves, which I actually thought was better than I expected.
Okay.
And I think the reason why everyone was shit-canning it, let's face it, is, spoiler alert, it feels the need to have this last-minute twist. I won't say what it is.
Sure.
But it comes across after the film that followed it as so unnecessary and weird and offhand, I think that spoiled people on the film that preceded it.
I think maybe just people aren't sold on Gerard Butler as a movie star.
Perhaps.
He gets a lot of chances.
I have no problem with Gerard Butler. And then I saw Molly's Game.
Okay. Because
there's nothing I like better than watching 2 hours of people speechifying. And there's
Jessica Chastain speechifying, I don't give a shit what she's saying.
And this is something I think I got from you, because as I sat through the film, I had plenty of time to think about other things. And I was remembering how you and Adam really find her to be stunningly beautiful and talented.
Yes.
And certainly you have that to look at. The film felt like it was 5 hours long to me. Not that I mind it. I have nothing else to do. But the thing I found so fascinating about it was the Michael Cera character is based on truth, as is the entire story, because it's based on a book by... There was a real Molly Bloom, and she ran a poker game.
Right.
And if what I've read is true, the real actor that Michael Cera is supposed to be is just the worst human being on the planet. Just, it's not a good public relations thing for...
It's Tobey Maguire.
Oh.
Yeah.
I read it was someone else.
Oh, who did you read it was?
I read it was Topher Grace.
Oh, interesting.
Because Topher Grace is at the beginning of Ocean's 12.
Ocean's 11.
No, isn't 12?
He's in both. He's in both. That's the joke. He shows up again in the hotel room in Ocean's 12, but in Ocean's 11,
it's the
Brad
poker.
Pitt
okay,
is, yeah, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Teaching him poker.
Hey, we're both right.
And Topher Grace makes some sort of offhand comment. I phoned in the Dennis Quaid movie, which is interesting because In Good Company was one of the films I considered for today, because there's parts of that film, none of the Topher Grace stuff, the Dennis Quaid stuff.
Yeah,
Dennis Quaid gives some interesting advice in that movie about being married.
Okay.
And being in a successful marriage. And I don't remember the rest of the film. I don't remember Scarlett Johansson being in it.
She's the daughter.
Right.
That Topher Grace is
but
like romancing.
I have remembered one of Dennis Quaid's lines.
Okay.
I mean, what year did that movie come out?
This was a while ago.
It was a long time ago. He said the key to a successful marriage is to find someone you want to spend time in the foxhole with and keep it in your pants.
Right.
That's great advice. That's great
advice. I remember thinking that movie was okay.
But
it tried to be about some things.
If the Michael Cera character is based on Tobey Maguire, Tobey Maguire isn't a very good person. But believe it or not, I enjoyed the film for what it was.
Sure.
Lots of speechifying. And then I braved...
There's that bench scene. I got the funniest text from Adam after he saw it because he brought up Jessica Chastain and Kevin Costner sitting together. What a lucky bench.
And that scene, maybe because I live in the Midwest and we're having a spate of bad weather, she's skating and he corners her in this park. I mean, maybe it's Central Park. I don't know. And they sit down on a bench and they talk for a real long time because this is an Aaron Sorkin movie. And I just sat there and said, aren't you cold? Can't you go to Starbucks or something? That looks really uncomfortable. Lucky bench.
Yeah.
I braved the elements and the drive, and I went to the Music Box Theater, the happiest place on earth, and I saw a documentary called Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story.
I know of it.
And I want to recommend it to all of our listeners because it seems to me that a lot of documentaries of this type revolve around some sort of aha or twist where at some point it becomes about a lot more than it seems to be about.
Yeah.
And these type of documentaries, I don't quite have a name for the subgenre, seem to succeed or fail based on the, aha, but wait. And in Bombshell, it's like, holy God, this is true?
Damn it.
And I don't want to give it away.
I have to see it.
And I think if people are patient, one thing that had me crestfallen was, as the show began in the small theater at the Music Box, boo, it was preceded by the American Masters logo. So I have a feeling if everyone's patient,
right.
It'll show up on PBS in a couple months. But the filmmakers did an amazing job. They found a journalist who had interviewed her on tape maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and he still had the tapes. The film begins with him finding the tapes where he left them in his office. And so she narrates big portions of it because they had this audio interview. And I knew very little about Hedy Lamarr other than the Blazing Saddles joke, which, to the film's credit, they dispense with very early in the film. But then later on, Mel Brooks comes back as a talking head to say something mind-blowing. You have to see it. It's really, really, wow. It's the best documentary I've seen this year. And then finally, my wife and I went to see the Academy Award nominated shorts live action. Later this week, we will see animation. And I recommend it. They're all real good, but I give you this recommendation with a caveat. They're very dark and they're very serious. There's five of them. One of them is a comedy, and that's placed in the program in a good spot because you need a little relief. Two of them made me cry. It's not light. It's heavy, heavy stuff.
Okay.
And another piece of evidence that I don't want to go out to the movies anymore for the rest of my life is the gentleman sitting next to my wife. A, took off his shoes and socks during the film and reclined his chair. So here we have apparently a hillbilly. And then halfway through the first short, fell asleep and began to loudly snore. So
what are we doing?
The $11 for a ticket has become this is this guy's hotel.
But
he's effectively turned it into his hotel room.
But aren't movie theaters somewhat complicit in that with the recliners and the we'll bring you food? And
I felt like jostling him because the snoring was bothering me. But I believe as we get closer to the Oscars, which don't matter, there will be a way to see them online. My wife suggested that this far out, there's always a chance to see him in a movie theater.
Yeah.
And then one year it was iTunes, and it was very nice when they did that, but somehow that didn't last. Every year I recommend doing it because then you can win your office Oscar pool because you'll have those two categories
or
down.
Your Oscar pool.
Yes.
I tried like 2 years ago. We started to watch the live-action shorts. The very first one, I want to say, was about somebody working at like a suicide hotline.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of had a panic attack and had to leave the room, and I haven't gone back.
Like I said, I don't want to ruin anything, but when it was over, the theater, which was nicely crowded, everyone sort of stood up and looked at each other, and there was this unspoken, we've just been through this together. Yeah. They're very heavy, although all five of them are very well made.
Oh, good.
And as I used to say to my son, when you're making a short, you have a difficult job because a lot of people take one joke and sort of expand it to 10 minutes. Right. And what's more popular is you'll see someone who took a feature and tried to do it in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to get enough stuff. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's what these five films excelled at, but they're heavy.
Yeah. Here's the thing. It is now the 12th of February.
Yes.
I have not gone out to see a movie in 2018 yet. I've not been to a theater in at least 6 weeks at this point.
Maybe your goal for the year should be no outside screen.
It's a bummer. And part of it is there's not been that much to compel me to go out.
No.
And part of it is just being busy, having to travel and all this nonsense, you know, because otherwise I probably would have gone to see Den of Thieves or something like that, right? Anyway, so I've been watching stuff at home, and Netflix keeps premiering films. Yeah. So there were a handful of Netflix films that I thought we would talk about. First, I'll bring up that I finally saw the film adaptation of The Girl Next Door, because Jack Ketchum just passed away. And he's an author whose work I've read almost all of, I think. And yet I had never seen that adaptation of his work. And if you've read the book, it's really hard to read. It's really, really dark and ugly. And so I wondered how that was going to translate to film. And the answer is, it doesn't. Because what you get is sort of a TV movie with a little bit of ugliness implied, a little bit shown, but it just never feels like more than kind of a Lifetime movie. They do not do the book justice. And I'm not even positive I'm recommending the book, because it's really hard to read. But the movie was a letdown. And then a couple Netflix movies I thought I would bring up, since you and I were texting about it.
Yes.
A Futile and Stupid Gesture. Do I have that? There's a backwards, a Stupid and Futile Gesture.
Does it matter?
I guess not.
It's the life story of Doug Kenny.
Right.
And I had told you via text that I had had some friends see it on Netflix that first weekend, and they know that I'm into comedy, and people were texting me with how much they enjoyed it. So I had big expectations, because I think I've read five books about Kenny.
Are there five books worth?
Well, there's A Stupid and Futile Gesture, the book that's based on. There's Tony Hendra's book about baby boomer comedy that has these two massive chapters about National Lampoon, because he was there at the beginning and he experienced it, and some other books about National Lampoon. And so I held that close to my heart, given how close to my heart I held Animal House when I was in high school. And I saw what they were trying to do, but I think it fails for a number of reasons. The type of humor that the film delights in was not Kenny's sense of humor. It's like this gloss of a different type of comedy was placed on it, or they're giving him credit for things that he doesn't deserve credit for. I thought some of the casting choices were odd. Strangely enough, the one that I raised an eyebrow at when I read about it was Thomas Lennon as Michael O'Donoghue.
And perfect.
He does great.
He's perfect.
He transforms himself. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
but Will Hader, who I...
No.
I'm sorry.
Will Forte.
Will Forte. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Will Forte, who I really, really like.
Yeah.
I felt wasn't able to remove himself from Will Forte enough to play Kenny, because that's not how Kenny acted or what he sounded like.
Okay.
So again, I'm too close to the material, and I'm too familiar with what actually happened to accept this, even though at one point the screen freezes and there's a scroll
right.
of all the things we got wrong or changed.
Right.
But that, you know, acknowledging it doesn't, it just makes me question why you felt you had to change the original story. The thing that I had talked to you about was the film posits that there was a food fight at his wake. And there wasn't. Someone whose name I'm having a hard time. Oh, Paul Krasner was at the wake and thought about doing it. And he mentioned it to somebody and somebody said, do not
right.
do that.
Right.
So Krasner thought about doing it. The problem I had was that the real story is so much better and would have been a more appropriate ending, though maybe not to a Netflix movie. Doug Kenny and Henry Beard, who founded the National Lampoon, didn't see each other for a really long time. After Henry Beard accepted his payment and walked out of the National Lampoon, they did not get together. No one saw him, and no one was even sure if he was going to show up to the wake. Well, he did. And one of the pallbearers didn't show up. And at the very last minute, someone looked up and said, Henry, you. And Henry Beard became one of his pallbearers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe this is a different movie than the one David Wayne was trying to make. But if that was handled right, isn't that a more satisfying ending and a better wrap up to their story? And certainly their relationship is one of the things the film is about.
Yes and no. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I would rather see a dramatic sort of reenactment of, hey, here's what happened. And like you said, it's more emotionally satisfying. The food fight is stupid, but I get what it's trying to do. And even not knowing for sure that it didn't happen, watching the movie, I was like, I don't think this happened. But I get what they're trying to do, which is sort of saying, hey, here's what Doug Kenny's legacy is. Here's what he inspired, right? And so we have this ridiculous food fight. And like, so I get what it's going for in terms of that. It's a stupid moment and a stupid visual and just, I didn't like it, but I understand what it was going for. There was enough in it that I liked overall. And honestly, part of it, like you said, you're very close to it. I know way less. Most of what I know comes from that documentary, which I liked a lot more.
Yeah. One thing they did nail, and this was something that the author of the Futile and Stupid Gesture book brought to the party. Doug was living his entire life in the shadow of his father's disapproval and a quite literal, the wrong brother died syndrome.
Right.
And I think the film nailed that primarily in the way the father is mm-hmm. portrayed. I thought Annette O'Toole was sort of wasted as his mom, though. She wasn't given a lot to do.
No. And again, part of the fun for me was just seeing a bunch of people show up playing a bunch of people that I like. You know, like I'm an easy mark. Like, oh, there's Joel McHale playing Chevy Chase. And I have to admit that I laughed when the parents say something shitty to Doug Kenny, and then Chevy Chase's response is to go over to the drink cart and start falling down and just knocking things over. I thought that's very funny.
McHale nailed Chase because they had worked together on.
Right.
And McHale was on a talk show recently and said exactly how he did it. He said he noticed that Chase talked really low.
Okay.
And he said that was the key. And that's all he needed. I think our listeners should watch it.
Sure.
You all have Netflix. It's
right.
free.
Yeah,
you
right.
have 2 hours.
It's a David Wayne movie. There were certain touches that I liked. I wish the movie would have done more of it. Like, I get what you're saying about the scroll. I appreciate that it's breaking the fourth wall at times, given its subject matter. The one that I really liked was when it sort of showed the disillusion of his marriage through the, what was that series of pictures, the naked
Photo funnies. I thought that was well done.
Yeah.
And I also thought they nailed something that Tony Hendra talks about in his book that no one talks about. When Saturday Night Live became such a runaway success, everyone said, well, it's Second City. They put Second City on TV. But that's not quite it. It was National Lampoon.
Yeah.
It was National Lampoon on TV, and I thought the film did a good job making that point
right.
that anyone who didn't go on the Saturday Night Live train was left behind.
Right. Yeah. The guy playing Lorne Michaels was very good, too.
Yeah.
I liked it enough. A movie I did not like enough was during the Super Bowl. It was a big deal because a commercial. And before the end of 2017, I had published a list of here's all these movies that I'm looking forward to. One of those movies was called God Particle, and it was rumored to be the new Cloverfield movie. That was all I knew about it. So commercial comes on during the Super Bowl for the Cloverfield Paradox, formerly God Particle.
Streaming now. And I wonder...
Available soon, I think
it
said.
Oh, I thought it was that
during the Super Bowl, it was like available soon, because as soon as the Super Bowl ended, that's when it went live.
Okay, because I wondered... Because I'm not a sports fan, but this year's Super Bowl was really fun to watch.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
For a number of reasons.
Mostly
I wondered.
Lost.
I wondered how many people turned the Super Bowl off.
Oh, yeah.
To watch.
Everybody in our orbit, you know, was like, okay, here's
But at least they waited for the Super Bowl to be over.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, because, yeah, you had to. Did you watch it?
Not yet.
Okay.
I read some things.
It's not good.
So you've just saved me 2 hours, and in that 2 hours, I can go and re-see the movie that I will now call Molly's Bench.
Lucky Bench. It is so not good, I thought. And
well, I heard it was a movie, and then someone said, you know, with a little tinkering.
But that was 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Oh.
And that movie's great.
Oh, I thought it was The Paradox.
No, I mean, I'm saying they did that with 10 Cloverfield Lane, and it worked because it was a script that Damien Chazelle had written that they said, hey, you know what we could do to this is tweak it a little bit and make it a Cloverfield
right.
movie. So that's what they did. I'm guessing they did the same thing with God Particle. I haven't heard for
but
sure.
But they were not as successful.
It ties in much more directly
yeah.
to end, but for what purpose? It answers its midichlorians. It
okay.
answers a question that we don't need answers.
Just based on the trailer, I can see that they're playing the place setting game.
Why do I want any of that stuff? It doesn't. At no point during Cloverfield was I like, but where did it come from?
You want to see Darth Vader as a kid?
Who
do
cares?
You want to see him as a kid?
I have been a big fan of the previous two Cloverfield movies, and yeah. I just this whole movie, I was like, oh my god, I can't see another movie about a crew on a spaceship. As things start to go wrong, it's Alien, it's Sunshine, it's Event
well,
Horizon.
It's now the narrative of every theme park ride.
Right. But the stuff that goes wrong doesn't make any sense. Like, I feel bad. I did not like it at all.
I'm sure our listeners can find it if they're better at the Google than I am. I'm thinking maybe it was on Slate, but I'm not sure. Someone once wrote a tongue-in-cheek essay about major theme parks and how they got to get their act together because every ride they went on, something went wrong and everything went awry. And the essay was hilarious and got all the details right of the Jurassic Park ride at Universal.
I watched like somebody a year or two ago wrote an article about that alien attack and how it was such a mistake for Disney because it was just too scary.
It wasn't.
And there was a video, like an accompanying video of somebody going through the ride.
Right.
It just, the video, I hated. I could never go on that ride.
I swear to you, I was one of the lucky few. We showed up at Disney,
yeah.
and it had just opened,
yeah.
and we read the signs.
Right.
And so
right.
we kept Jake off, and I went on it, no. and it was the greatest thing ever. In fact, when they finished it, Michael Eisner wrote it and said it's not scary enough, and they ramped it up. Because what's scarier, you couldn't move, which is why kids freaked out.
Yes.
You could not physically get up and run out. And all the lights go out, and something's wrong, and there's something in the chamber, and you can hear it. And it actually breathes on the side of your face and steps down on your harness. It's theater of the mind. It was the greatest thing ever. It was so scary.
I don't like being scared in person. I love scary movies more than anything. I don't like being scared.
It's Disney.
Yeah.
You know you're not going to die.
Course, of course.
And if you do die, your entire family is set. For the rest.
But they're going to take me off the property before they pronounce me.
That is true. No one has ever died at Disney.
That's right. The last movie that I'll talk about is yet another Netflix premiere, because that's the way things are going now, unfortunately. And it was a movie that I was really looking forward to. It's called The Ritual, and it is the first feature directed by David Bruckner, who I'm a big fan of. He was part of the Signal. He directed, I believe, that middle segment where it's just like a demented party sort of.
I think
where
you showed me that.
I did. It was a scary movie yeah. 8 years ago with A.J. Bowen. And then he did the amazing sequence in Southbound about the surgery. He did Amateur Night in VHS.
Oh.
So he's been the highlight of all these different anthologies. So I was very excited to see his feature debut. It's getting very positive word of mouth from horror fans on the internet.
A lot of people tweeting last weekend about it.
Really liking it. I thought it was okay to decent. I really wanted to love it more. It just was a movie that I feel like I've seen a lot of times, and I won't say what the specific movies are that I could say, well, that's this, this, and this, but they were very prominent in my mind. I appreciate that it takes itself very seriously. It's not tongue-in-cheek. It's not goofy. It's very straightforward. There is a really cool monster in it, so I think it's worth seeing just for the cool monster. I absolutely think it's worth watching. Again, it's on Netflix. You can watch it essentially for free in your living room right now if you wanted to, as soon as the Super Bowl's over. but I was just a little bit let down, given my affection for the filmmaker.
Okay. In the spirit of the holiday,
yes.
I have brought with me some tiny conversation hearts. You have a box over
I
there,
do.
Mr. Rowley. And occasionally, we're going to turn to these hearts if we run out of things to say.
Yeah.
And we're going to use these tiny conversation hearts as a transition
All
into
right.
the next film. Now, what I'm interested in,
yes.
given that you're looking at two men who unashamedly love each other, who feel the love that dare not speak its name, I'm wondering how many films will be on both of our lists.
Interesting.
My guess is not many, because the parameters are so wide that
right.
we left it so.
Yeah. Ooh, I just found the most depressing romance heart.
And that is?
I Hope. Yikes.
What's that pad?
Ooh, here's one that says, If Only.
Ooh.
No, not really.
Conversation heart full of yellow regret. That Patton routine where he's going to text something to his wife, and it's got the
I hate.
That makes me sound like a robot. This one says real love. Real love. So I was sort of avoiding the regular Valentine's Day staples
yeah.
of...
Which would be what? Like Casablanca?
Casablanca would be number one.
That's the go-to.
The Music Box shows it every Valentine's Day. Stuff like The Notebook.
Okay.
Which a lot of people
love
point
story.
To.
Love Story?
Well, if you're interested, I wrote a column about Love Story. Love Story is a very odd, very peculiar film.
I've never seen it.
Oh.
But a girl I dated in high school, who you know,
mm-hmm.
insisted I read the book. So I've read the book, but I've never seen the movie.
Yeah, it's problematic. And what is it? Like My Best Friend's Wedding and Notting Hill and all of those things. So if you want to hear about those movies, you should go someplace else, because I'm talking about twisted, odd love.
Yes.
Or odd definitions of love.
Got it.
And the conversation heart says real love. So I guess that's what I'm talking about. Not Fannie Mae candy love.
No.
I'm talking about real love. My first film, which I've championed on the site before in various ways, is the film Once, the wonderful Glenn Hansard, Margaret Igleva.
Yes.
Musical, and I love Once because you see them falling in love, mm-hmm. and it's very realistic and very specific, and yet they don't so much as kiss, and the ending is bittersweet at best.
Yes.
So it's sort of an anti-Hollywood choice, where in Hollywood films, you know, boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. But as we all know in real life, sometimes that doesn't happen.
Sometimes you get the conversation heart that says, I hope.
What did you say? You had one that said, as if.
I don't remember. If only. Yeah.
So once is my if only chance. And you like that film, right?
I like it quite a bit.
And it was later turned into a Broadway musical where the gimmick was all of the music was actually being done live on stage, that all of the musicians were on the stage, and there was a lot of dancing and moving benches around. It reminded me of a musical group in TERP, which is a IHSA speech event where people put on a little show.
That sounds very antithetical to the movie's charm.
Yes. Although, I think you'd agree, the music in the movie is so good.
Of course.
And it gave the world that one song that later became a staple on American Idol. Every season, someone attempted it. Take this weary...
Yeah.
Right.
I can't remember what it's called, but I know the exact... It's like the theme, basically.
It's you're on a ship, and you're in love, and it's not going to end well. So my first alternate Valentine's Day film is Once.
The song is called Falling Slowly.
Yes.
I thought of it. Along those same lines, I will choose something that I think is kind of similar in terms of the way it executes the love story. And that is Billy Wilder's The Apartment, which is an amazing love story where once, not to spoil The Apartment, but
you've had plenty of time to see it.
It came out in 1960, so get with it. Where once again, we do not see the two ostensible romantic leads so much as kiss, although I would argue that its ending is more optimistic than Once. But it is very much a movie about loving someone and by virtue of the fact that you love them, they can hurt you very badly. Yes. And they may not know it. What Shirley MacLaine is doing isn't necessarily directly to hurt Jack Lemmon, but because he loves her, her life hurts him a great deal. And again, it's, you know, that whole Billy Wilder idea of the sour and the sweet, and nowhere is that better exemplified than in The Apartment.
And before we leave Billy Wilder territory, there's a film on my list called Some Like It Hot, which I think most people consider a comedy before they consider it a romance, but I want to suggest the following.
All right.
And this is not original to me. I don't have an original thought in my head. All my original thoughts are from my wife and from books. And I almost brought the book because I believe I showed it in high school. Most semesters, that was one of the examples of comedy. And Danny Perry, in his wonderful book, Cult Movies, talks about Some Like It Hot at some length in terms of gender roles. And he says he's pretty much convinced that Billy Wilder wasn't doing this on purpose, but he found it odd that when the two men, Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, are men, Tony Curtis is the brash, aggressive one, and Jack Lemmon is the stooge. He's the more passive one. And the minute they're forced to dress up like women, they change places. Jack Lemmon's Daphne becomes this brash, fun-to-be-with broad. And Tony Curtis becomes almost school marmish. She's sort of the reserved one. And that the two men dressed as women seek out, in one case a woman, in one case a man. We'll talk about that. But that when the Tony Curtis character falls for Marilyn Monroe, Marilyn Monroe is very much the aggressor in that relationship because he sets up the double subterfuge that he's the millionaire who can't fall in love. But that, given that we're looking at a film where nothing is as it appears to be, everything is disguised, their desires are disguised as well. Mm-hmm. And in becoming women, this is a bad line from Tootsie, they actually discover what they want as men. Okay. And of course, that leads to, could it be the single most famous ending in movie history? Certainly one of the greatest last lines in movie history.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the most famous last
line
in movie history.
And talk about being ahead of the curve, that Jack Lemmon wrongly thinks he can't be with Osgood because he's a man, but that is not correct. And that takes us to the scene in their hotel room where they've both spent the night with their lovers, and they come back to talk about it, and Jack Lemmon says, "Congratulate me, I'm engaged."
Yeah.
And Tony Curtis says, "But Osgood is a guy, and why would a guy want to marry another guy?" And there's a pause, and Jack Lemmon says, "Security." And we are leaping into another world.
Yeah.
Famous story that Jack Lemmon told a lot when they were filming that. Jack Lemmon's been out dancing, and he's got these two maracas. And Jack and Billy Wilder said, I want you to shake those and hum the tune between each line. And Jack Lemmon much later discovered it's because Wilder knew that, those lines, the whole conversation is hilarious. Congratulate me. Osgood proposed. Who's the lucky guy? I am. That the maraca shaking and the humming was so that the laughs wouldn't step on the next line. People consider it one of the greatest comedies ever made.
Sure.
But I would argue it's also one of the great romances, though not a conventional one.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Billy Wilder, man, he's one of those guys that like...
The Apartment, Some Like It Hot, and then Ace in the Hole, which...
Sunset Boulevard, Double Indemnity.
Ace in the Hole is slowly getting the reputation it deserves, though it's taking way too long.
Well, it was so far ahead of its time when
it
came out.
He had to wait for, like, media to catch up to the level of sleaze.
Yes. Yes.
That he presents.
For the world to become as cynical as that movie.
Yeah.
Which, hey, we're there. So good job, everyone. It's crazy. I don't know what this means. This one just says L-Y-M-Y. And right now there's some love you, miss you. Would that be?
I'm guessing.
I'm like, there's some millennial right now who's like, you dumbass, you old man. Love you, miss you.
This one says, snooches. And I thought, so they're Kevin Smith fans. Snooches, gabooches, or whatever it is.
This one has the tiniest little writing. And it says, if I can't have you, no one will.
You're making that up.
I am making that up.
That won't fit on the heart.
It says, text me.
This says, that's the modern one.
Right.
This one does say smooches.
Yeah.
I was making a joke.
Snooches. Which are Dr. Seuss characters, right?
Just yes.
The snooches have
And some smooches and smooches have stars upon theirs.
My second pick is King Kong.
And you have now.
Okay.
That is on my list as well.
Okay. I mean, I guess you could pick any of the King Kongs, although I would argue that the Dino De Laurentiis one is the least romantic of the three. And I don't know why that is. Perhaps because the Rick Baker ape is the least sexy of the three?
Maybe. And one could even argue that the Peter Jackson version sort of goes out of its way to be even more romantic. There's two.
Well, what with the hardcore scene, which I thought was a bridge too far, but.
And by the hardcore scene, you mean King Kong on Ice? My least favorite film. In a film that, like you had mentioned this a couple weeks or months ago, I can no longer keep track of time, that every time you see the Peter Jackson King Kong, you like it more?
Yeah. Well, I liked it a lot the first time I saw it.
Okay.
I've always liked it.
I like half of it.
Okay.
I like it all, everything until they get to New York.
Okay. It's not a movie I rewatch very often.
No,
it's too much of a commitment.
It was on cable a lot around Christmas.
TNT was going. They love to show King Kong.
But there's two essays about King Kong that offer an interpretation that make it perfect for alternative Valentine's Day viewing. One of them suggests that while Kong is presented as the other, clearly what's going on is that Kong is a substitute for a black man.
Right.
And all of our feelings about that. So it's about a mixed race relationship. My favorite interpretation, though, and I wish I could remember the author or where I read it, is that Kong is a symbol of Denham's unconscious. Mm. Denham is not happy about Jack Driscoll and the Fay Wray character obviously hitting it off and falling in love, and that if you watch the film that way, Kong is a manifestation of his anger and his lust down to how few scenes they share.
He and Kong?
Yes.
Okay.
Until we get to the theater at the end when Kong runs amok.
Right.
I don't agree with it 100%. I think it's an interesting interpretation.
Sure.
But clearly, there's something going on between Kong and Anne.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not a doctor.
You have misrepresented yourself on this podcast.
That was as my credentials as a psychiatrist. I am not a medical doctor.
Got it.
But the physical act of love between Anne and Kong is going to be difficult.
Correct.
But that's what I like so much about the film, because I like them both as characters.
Mm-hmm.
They'll figure something out.
those kids will make it work.
They will.
I didn't put it on my list. I don't know if it's on yours, so I don't want to step on it. But again, that's, you know, most recently we had The Shape of Water.
Yes.
Which speaks to all of us who watched King Kong and thought, those kids are going to make it work. Because a lot of people watch King Kong and say, well, he's the monster. He has to fall off the building. He's the bad guy. Kill the ape. And when my monkey died, people going to cry.
Again, like the original Frankenstein, I don't consider Kong to be the monster.
Right. No, of course not. And I don't know if that's us as movie fans or us as monster fans, right? And so that's one of the things we love about The Shape of Water, is that Del Toro is such a monster fan that he says, well, I'm going to have them get together, finally. But yeah, King Kong.
And just to engage in a small tangent,
yes,
about monsters, you have been in my family room.
I have.
Which a few years ago we remodeled and made it a space we actually wanted to spend time in and did all these things. And my wife, who loves me, allowed me to decorate the family room because I'm 12. You know what I'm referring
to. Of course.
And so I have these Mondo posters for the original Universal Studios monsters, but there was one caveat.
Mm.
I don't know if you've noticed it or if I've told you this story. The only monsters allowed on the walls are monsters that are more victims than agents of mayhem.
Interesting.
And so we have Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
Which I just put up by the pinball game.
Okay, nice.
Frankenstein.
Creature Corner. Yeah.
Frankenstein.
Yeah.
King Kong.
Right.
The Wolfman.
Okay.
The Mummy.
Right.
And the Invisible Man.
No Dracula.
Because that's a hard one
right.
to...
Sure.
You know, he's going to steal your soul. He's going
right.
to turn you into the...
What about the Gary Oldman Dracula? He's a romantic.
He's just looking for a girlfriend. He just wants his girlfriend. Can you lay off? And Van Helsing's crazy. He's a crazy man.
I have walked in the shadow of death. I love you too much.
That's a pretty good
I kind of roll my eyes.
So obviously...
Because he looks like Svengoolie and he's hard to take seriously.
Last week on Svengoolie, Dana Gould was the guest.
Nice.
And I guess because the movie was so short, they actually sat down and had two segments where they just talked about stuff.
Nice.
It was great.
Yeah.
They talked about killer animal movies. And of course, they both waxed rhapsodic about Night of the Lepus. And it was so clear that Gould has seen it so many times that he's like memorized it, because he's talking about scenes in such crazy specific detail, down to what they sound like on the soundtrack
when they
stampede.
Right.
It was great. If you get a chance, it's the Svengoolie episode about Tarantulas, The Deadly Cargo, which was made for TV in like the late 70s.
I haven't seen that one.
It's delicious.
What's next for you?
Okay, you got me on King Kong, so we have that one in common. And I hesitate to bring the next one up because it's become a cliche, but then I began to wonder if all of our listeners have actually seen it. The film is Harold and Maude.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I wonder if it still works.
It does.
It was quite a slap in the face when I first saw it, which wasn't exactly when it first came out, but pretty close. The school district that I used to work for and that Patrick went to used to have this thing every year called Film Day. And when I was in high school, we all went to Arlington High School, now defunct, and the crazy teacher in charge showed us Harold and Maude. It doesn't all date. Not all of it.
I may disagree. And here's why. And then obviously you should finish. But the first time I saw it was when the Criterion Blu-ray was released. So we're talking about the last few years. And what I think has helped make it feel more contemporary is Wes Anderson. Because I watch Harold and Maude and I say, oh, it's like this and Truffaut are the two biggest influences on Wes Anderson.
That's
right?
Good. Yeah.
And so it feels contemporary now because he has brought a specific aesthetic back into sort of contemporary filmmaking, that's the only reason I feel like it hasn't dated.
And I think the reason why I think it might date is because, A, I haven't seen it in a dog's age, and B, I can't divorce myself from my wife. I tried. There's all this paperwork. There's all this money. I'm joking. I can't divorce myself from Happy Valentine's Day, Channy. I can't divorce myself from how I felt about it at the time.
Okay.
So because I'm a sophomore in high school, I'm afraid the film is stuck back then.
Okay.
But some of it was so cutting edge doesn't do enough to explain it. Some of it is so out there, yeah, even for today. I'm thinking of his original suicide attempts, mm-hmm, and the way that's presented, mm-hmm, especially given that we have a more enlightened opinion about ideas about suicide. But it's so funny. And then in the second half, it just becomes very, very sweet,
yeah,
and very moving in terms of how the Maude character changes and shapes the Harold character. Obviously, if you've never seen it, you need to. But I think it is an unconventional Valentine's Day movie.
It certainly is. And it's, you know, I think the first movie that pops into our heads when we're trying to think of unconventional Valentine's or unconventional romance movies, because it is a very unconventional romance and sort of is the textbook definition of an unconventional romance. I was blown away by it when I saw it. And again, I was,
it makes me happy,
only in recent years. And we should mention that our mutual friend Lauren is obsessed with Harold and Maude. It is her favorite movie. One year I attended a Harold and Maude themed party at her house where she had an outdoor screening of the film.
Wow.
Yeah. And played Cat Stevens music, and it was a whole thing. We all tried to kill ourselves. My next pick is, I think,
wait a minute,
more conventional, so I apologize
well, you
for
can't,
this.
According to you, you can't get more conventional than Harold and Maude.
No,
so
that's not
I've
true.
Just set the table for
it's
convention.
It's conventionally unconventional, or is it unconventionally conventional? It doesn't even sound like a word anymore.
Well, once you go back and forth.
Conventional. Nah.
What it means is that eventually the stars of the film will show up at a convention.
The Philadelphia Story. Which is new to Blu-ray from Criterion, and again, is a, you know, famous kind of screwball comedy. But what I love about the movie is that for a long time, you know, it opens with a couple splitting up,
yeah,
and then spends a long time convincing you that it's going to be about a different couple getting together, and then flips one more time before the end. And I'm just a fan of movies. One of the other movies on my list that I'm not probably going to talk about, which is a movie called Casual Sex. And I've mentioned this movie so many times.
Oh.
As an example of a movie that misdirects you in terms of who's going to end up together at the end. Because you would not watch the first two-thirds of Casual Sex and know who the couple is going to be at the end. But it comes by it honestly. It's
not just...
And it's very sweet. And so few movies are able to do that.
No, there's a lot to like in that movie.
Yeah, no, I'm a fan of that movie. But so many movies... You watch, and from the first 5 minutes, you say, oh, okay, this is the couple. This is who's going to end up together. And the Philadelphia Story, I think, kind of is able to do that, where it makes you think it's going to be about Katharine Hepburn sort of rebounding with Jimmy Stewart, and then it takes a different direction. But
because what we don't realize is that in the Philadelphia Story, Jimmy Stewart is playing Ralph Bellamy.
Right, exactly.
And you don't want to check the Googles on this, but I think TCM and Fathom Events have released the entire schedule for the year of their classic screenings. I think the Philadelphia Story is the February one.
Oh, okay.
I think you can actually see it in a movie theater. Of course, there's a Criterion one. My introduction to that film was as part of a Robert Youngson compilation. Robert Youngson rode roughshod over the MGM library in the 50s and 60s and put out these compilation films that actually played in theaters when comedy was king. And it has all these clips,
wow,
and his narration, and they showed them endlessly on Channel 9, and that was my introduction because when I was a child, well, you know. And one of the scenes was if not the first scene, one of the first scenes in Philadelphia Story where Cary Grant is leaving the house and Katharine Hepburn's very upset,
yeah,
and breaks the golf club over,
yeah,
her knee.
Yeah.
And I was young and impressionable. Cary Grant walks up to her in the doorway and takes her face in his hands and pushes her down on the floor. And it's presented
and that's
as comedy.
How the movie starts.
And I'm like, holy shit. This is from the 40s?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. A couple years ago, we went to Austin, and there's a big, beautiful theater there called the Paramount that often will do like stage productions, but then shows movies as well. And we got to see a print of the Philadelphia Story.
I'm jealous.
It was amazing. We sat in the balcony.
That's so cool. That's a real good choice.
Thanks.
I remember when theaters had balconies. My next unconventional Valentine's Day movie, and this one's good because it deals with the heart, is Let the Right One In.
Sure.
Which most uninformed people consider a horror film.
The fools.
But of course it's not. It's a romance. It's a very twisted, unconventional romance.
Yeah.
And it basically asks, if you truly fell in love with someone, would their gender or occupation really matter? And would you be okay carting them around in a box on a train? I'm sure most of our listeners have seen it, but the one part that doesn't get talked about a lot is the building relationship between the two main characters and how it really is sort of this courtship and this romance. Of course, she is courting him for different reasons, but I think at the end, like the book did, the film asks us questions about what we get out of any relationship and what we expect to get out of a relationship. And in that way, that just makes it a much deeper horror film.
And the original Norwegian film is obviously so much better in terms of asking those questions and some of those questions about gender that you bring up. I will say that the one area that I think the American remake, Let Me In, is better is in the relationship between the young vampire and her older handler.
And I would agree with you. Yeah. And part of that is because in the American version, it's Richard Jenkins.
Right.
I recently revisited that film.
Okay.
Let Me In.
Yes.
And this was years ago. I may have been a little harsh because in the original podcast, we were comparing the two of them.
That was, I think, our first year as a
podcast. My love for Let the Right One In was so strong, I would not accept this interloper for my affection.
Sure.
Puppy love.
Yeah, that's a good one.
No, that's what this little heart says.
Oh, good. Puppy Mine love. Just says bling, which is not a romantic expression.
Well, no, that's the romantic call of the prostitute. If you supply me with enough material goods, jewelry, and money.
I have a puppy love also.
I have one I've been avoiding that says let's kiss. And I was going to sort of...
Please don't avoid it.
Secret. I was going to secret that one in my pocket and try to use that on my wife later tonight. Maybe leave it on her pillow.
Perhaps. My next pick, staying a little bit on the horror tip, is The Abominable Dr. Fibes, which is a love story.
Love means never having to say you're ugly.
That's right.
That was the tagline on the poster.
Love
that was the
means punish
story.
Every one of those motherfuckers. Again, it's in keeping with what you were saying about the Universal Monsters. You know, Dr. Fibes is essentially a victim and is behaving in a way that is not.
The whole Art Deco aesthetic of that film and how complicated and fetishized his revenge is.
Yes.
Speaks either to him as a sociopath or, in terms of the theme of the show, speaks to his love for his wife.
He's not going to half-ass it
for his wife. This is not the guy who brings home Walgreens flowers.
Right. Or,
speaking of Walgreens.
Always.
I was just at Walgreens.
Like from Walgreens?
Yes. And I held my tongue. I had the funniest joke, but I didn't say it because I didn't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy anymore. The person behind me had this industrial-sized box of diapers. It was huge.
Okay.
Pampers.
Yeah.
And a Valentine's Day card.
Okay.
That's what she was buying. And for as God is my witness, I wanted to turn around, look at the Pampers, look at the Valentine's Day card, and say, I'm not going to judge you. But I didn't.
Good. Good for you.
I did not. Good for you. Good for you.
Anyway, that's it, Dr. Fibes.
My next unconventional Valentine's Day movie is Moonrise Kingdom.
Sure.
Which I love because it's a Wes Anderson film, and I love it because it's sweet. Mm-hmm. I also think it's unconventional because it gets into a matter that these are two children. Mm-hmm. And there were parts of the film the first time I saw it that made me feel very uncomfortable. But given that they were sort of describing the way we meet people and make friends and maybe start to forge a romantic relationship, I'm thinking of the scene on the beach where they strip and they dance.
Yeah.
And that scene made me really uncomfortable.
Sure.
Especially because at one point he apologizes because he has an erection.
Sure.
But it wasn't done exploitatively. It was done – the thing I always compare Wes Anderson's work to lately is really good 70s young adult literature. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of his movies, specifically Moonrise Kingdom and parts of Royal Tannenbaums, remind me of a book called From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler by E.L. Konigsberg about two – children who run away and live in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I think Wes Anderson was very influenced by that book because pieces of it show up in a lot of his movies. But you don't think Moonrise Kingdom was exploitative.
No, and I understand feeling that way about that scene because on the one hand, it's like transcendent. I love the dancing, you know?
Yeah.
But we're looking at children in their underwear and we are again programmed to say, well, that's dirty and that's wrong because I'm not the person who likes that. And there's nothing salacious about it. We're not meant to be ogling either one of them, but I think our natural instinct is to be like, ah, I'm not supposed to see that.
And certainly given that every other romantic relationship that we see in the film is failing or has failed, they're sort of this beacon.
Right.
Because if memory serves, at the end of the film, they're dating and they're very happy.
Yeah.
And it's very wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a great film. And I think it speaks to a certain kind of love in a way that the other films that we're talking about today have. And I tried to find films that talk about love in different ways.
Sure. Sure, sure. My next pick is a film about the love between a boy and a robot. And that is Turbo Kid, which I've talked a lot about on this podcast. But again, going back to this idea of, well, I don't care that you're a robot. I accept you as you are, and I love you as you are, is very, very beautiful to me. And that's part of what I love about that movie.
And as all of us discovered when Turbo Kid came out, how can you not fall in love with
Apple?
Apple. It's just this performance, yeah. And I know that behind my back, all of my friends make fun of me because I have this love affair with a show on QVC called In the Kitchen with David. But go with me on this.
All right.
I think the appeal of David is very much the appeal of Apple, that they are both presented unironically.
Yes.
David, in trying to sell you household appliances and expensive gourmet food, is the least ironic person I've ever seen on TV. There's no double meaning. There's no guile. There's no context because, God forbid, they should talk about politics or something. He eats this and he likes it. And he says, if you buy this, it will make your life better.
Yeah.
And David is very much like Apple in Turbo Kid.
I remember the first time I saw Turbo Kid.
I remember the first time you saw Turbo Kid, too.
And I know others have said, you know, well, I knew she was a robot or something from the moment she came on screen. And I did not. And I was fascinated by the acting choices that Lawrence mm-hmm. LaBeouf was making because I was like, well, I'm just taking it at face value. You're just a human being who's very odd. And so then once it's revealed that she's a robot, it contextualizes how kind of weird her choices are. But again, I like movies with romance in them, especially a good romance that is sweet and genuine. And Turbo Kid, as a movie that has everything that's just for me, the fact that it manages to also include an effective romance is just part of why I love it.
I can still remember the first time you saw Turbo Kid. Because it changed you, and you couldn't stop talking about it.
No.
Do you remember?
Yes.
It was something.
I think I said something like, if you don't like Turbo Kid, I'm not positive we can be friends. And that's an overstatement, but it's also not.
And I think I'm looking down my list, and this might speak to Patrick and I getting old. It seems that more and more there's so little sweetness in life. That I know I'm beginning to prize it in movies.
Of course.
If the movie can genuinely, not
treacle
or saccharine,
right.
But if the movie can honestly be sweet. That being said, my next choice is a little sweet and sour, and I present it half apologizing for it.
Interesting.
It's called Secretary.
Oh, don't apologize for that.
And I think it's fascinating, but... how can I put this? Last weekend, Dean Richards, who reviews films for WGN. No, he has a reputation as a lightweight, but he reviewed...
Isn't he the one who called it Polish Ida?
Yes. And also, he...
We miss you,
Doug. Doug used to point out that, that he mispronounces biopic.
Oh, biopic.
Biopic.
Yeah.
But I have an amount of affection for Dean Richards because he's on Ironic, too. And he reviewed... 50 Shades Free on the TV. And his review was hilarious. But he started by saying, to start with, this film is not intended for me.
Right.
Which is honest.
Sure.
But then did a level of introspection that I'm not used to seeing in Dean Richards. He said, given the social climate of the times, this film seems very retrograde in terms of the woman being under the man's thumb. And I wonder if I wouldn't feel so guilty about Secretary if the roles were reversed. Because I think there's too much entertainment where it is shown that somehow the woman actually likes being treated that way. But clearly in Secretary, she does.
Yes.
And the two of them, to borrow a cliche, complete each other.
Right.
And the end of that film... is troubling but sweet on its own terms.
Yes.
I mean, they find a way to make it work.
Yes.
But it's dark.
Yes, and no.
It goes to some dark places.
I don't know that I've seen it since theaters.
Okay.
So there might be, I think there's like a third act that I'm kind of forgetting.
The third act is sort of happy and they're together and I believe they wed and I mean, clearly they're perfect for each other.
Right.
I just think we have to tread lightly because the film...
Sure.
Part of the film is about the fact that he hits her.
Right.
And this
hits her like in the face?
No.
Spanks her.
Yeah, they're spanking.
Yeah.
And that...
She's into it.
Right.
But some people are.
Sure.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
I think the treading lightly, at least now, I think would almost have more to do with the power dynamics, which I also know the movie is about.
Right. And I remember going to see it when it came out, and I was really impressed by it.
Yeah.
And I was impressed by all the landmines it avoided.
Yeah.
Primarily because of the performance of Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a movie that... on its face seems to suggest like, okay, well, these are two, for lack of a better word, broken people who complete each other, as you said. But the more you look at it, it's, well, no, they're not broken.
No.
Actually, Maggie Gyllenhaal in particular kind of knows exactly who she is and what she wants. And the movie is essentially about her sort of unlocking that in James Spader. Yes. If I'm remembering correctly. Okay. No, I think it's a great pick.
Because of the way it's done. In the wrong hands, you could see it being a really bad Cinemax movie.
Well, it's or, 50 Shades of Grey.
Exactly.
Right.
50 Shades
right.
of Secretary.
Or 50 Shades Darker or 50 Shades Freed. I saw the first 50 Shades of Grey. I haven't seen the second two.
I have cleverly avoided all of them as I read
staggeringly bad
that the original book started as Twilight fan fiction.
I've heard that as well.
I'm out.
My next pick is a very conventional romantic comedy, And I know you're thinking, but Patrick, you guys said you were doing unconventional romantic movies. Yeah,
that's what I was told.
But see, the joke here is just how conventional it is.
I know what you're going to say.
Because it's They Came Together.
Almost made my list.
A David Wayne movie that is sort of the antidote to every romantic comedy that you might watch on Valentine's Day, because it is skewering all of them very accurately.
But am I remembering it correctly? Because, again, we saw it under the most perfect conditions for seeing a movie.
Yeah.
A crowded house at the Music Box Theater with the filmmaker in attendance.
The opening night of a film festival.
Everyone was there to love this film. But my memory is, besides skewering all the conventions, because of Rudd and Poehler and their chemistry, it actually kind of also works as a romantic comedy.
Yeah, well, we like them and we want to see them get together, sure. It's just really funny and really smart about what it chooses to make fun of.
And since it came out, we've disproved that our initial reaction was exaggerated because of the conditions we saw it. It's terrific. And we,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No,
I still think
it's really funny. Oh, sure. And it's one of those movies where after you see it, you wonder, well, how can I ever sit through another conventional romantic comedy again? And they're still being made, so obviously it's not the movie that broke them.
It didn't kill the genre.
Because it barely made an impact. But it is very, very funny, and if you're sick of those kinds of movies, basically anything with Kate Hudson, watch They Came Together on Valentine's Day instead.
It's really funny. My next film I had almost forgotten about, because this filmmaker has this habit of making these films that I love, and then they sort of fly away, and you wonder if they existed. Hmm. The film is called Enough Said.
Okay.
And it's a romantic comedy with Julia Louis-Dreyfus and James Gandolfini.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. It's a farce. They have chemistry together. But then I thought about Nicole Holofcener, right?
Yes.
Friends with Money.
Yes.
Please Give.
Yes.
That she's really good at making these films about really specific people, and I wonder why the films don't get more attention.
Yeah, I mean, that one's obviously sad because it came out after Gandolfini had passed. And I like so much of the movie. I like their performances a lot. I like what it has to say about trying to build a relationship once you are of a certain age. You know, usually Nancy Myers kind of has the market cornered.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm an adult in love. Diane Keaton is so flustered. I struggle with Enough Said because there's a layer of romantic comedy bullshit to it that bums me out.
The plot complication that somehow we feel that we need.
Just make the movie about the two of them.
Yeah, we don't need it.
No.
It's beneath the film.
It's beneath her because her previous movies avoided all of that bullshit.
Yeah.
I still like the movie, but I found that aspect of it very frustrating. And if you're not aware of what we're talking about, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus essentially misleading characters about who she is for no goddamn reason. My next pick is Anna Biller's The Love Witch.
Hmm.
Have you seen The Love Witch yet?
Not yet.
You're a monster.
This week they're showing it at the Gene Siskel Film Center on 35mm film.
Or you could just like watch it on Amazon Prime for free.
I own it. On the disc.
What are you doing? You need to watch it.
I'm watching as many Japanese crime films from the 60s as I possibly can.
Would it help if I told you it heavily features the Yakuza?
You're making that. You're teasing me.
I just want you to watch it. I can't remember if...
You're teasing me the way you do.
Oh, here's a conversation heart that says, oh my God, it says, fuck you, tease.
Doesn't say that. My conversation heart says, wink, wink. Wink, wink, say no more, nudge, nudge.
I can't remember if this showed up. I remember a year ago to this day that this podcast came out was the first article that Alejandra wrote for the site. And she wrote about Valentine's Day or horror movies to watch on Valentine's Day, and happy anniversary, Alejandra. I can't remember if she mentioned The Love Witch or not. I know she's a big fan of it, but it's not really a romance necessarily, but it is very much a movie about love and who people, specifically in this case, I think because of who Anna Biller is, women think that they need to be versus who they want to be. It's so good.
Maybe that's what I'll watch Wednesday night.
Please do.
With my Lou Malnati's heart-shaped pizza.
I can't even have one because I have to teach.
Oh, I forgot that's Wednesday night. You doing something special for Valentine's?
I should, but I don't know
you
what.
Bring candy. They'd like that.
Candy? I want candy.
Candy. Any kind will do. My next film has so many happy memories for a number of reasons. I think it might have been the first Criterion Blu-ray I ever bought.
Ooh, Blu-ray.
It's Wim Wenders Wings of Desire.
Ah, yes.
And it
the remake
is,
of City of Angels.
Oh my God. But the original.
I don't want the world to see me.
The original is in wonderful black and white, although there is a color sequence. And the film concerns a guardian angel who we're told silently watches people and tries to make them feel better with a hand on the shoulder. It suggests that guardian angels hang out in public libraries, which I really like a lot. And the angel in question, and I'm trying to remember the actor's name, falls in love with a human living woman. She's a tightrope artist in a circus and has a decision to make if he wants to stay a guardian angel or become human again and all that that entails, and perhaps start a relationship with her. Peter Falk is in it in the most crazy cameo on earth. It's suggested that Peter Falk, the actor, is either a guardian angel or can see the guardian angels, that he's a special human. It's just the craziest thing. And a long time ago, when the film first came out, a friend of mine, a buddy of mine who taught film at Buffalo Grove, we used to do these things where we would pick four foreign films and we would go to five area libraries and show them and then lead a discussion on them. And these screenings were not well attended because of the films that we had at our disposal. But for some weird glitch in the space-time continuum, we got Wings of Desire after its theatrical run, before it was on any sort of home video.
Oh, that's cool.
And we went to four different libraries, and it was packed.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, it was free.
Right.
Everyone had heard of the film. And we had these amazing discussions. And afterwards, people came up to us, because Dale was tall and thin, and I am short and stout, and they said, you too know so much about film, you're like Ebert and Siskel, because if you know about film, and you're tall and skinny and short and stout, well, there's only one thing you can be.
That's right.
Ebert and Siskel. And we actually got paid for doing this, and it was so much fun, and I think we did it for 2 or 3 years, and then we ran out of juice. But that was fun. And the film is amazing. And I just found out today that parts of it are based on the work of the poet Rilke. And Jan is making extensive use of Rilke in the book that she's writing right now, mm-hmm. which is a book of poems about the movie Blade Runner.
Right.
Which is nearing completion.
Oh my gosh, I'm so
and it's
excited.
It's amazing. In fact, she just found out that three of the poems had been accepted for publication in this journal.
Wow.
So those are going to come out. And when we get closer, I'll tell you all about it, because
yes.
It's a book you're going to dig. But all of these things are wrapped up in a beautiful Valentine's Day bow. You need to see Wings of Desire.
Do you know I've never seen it? I've owned it for years, and I've never seen it.
I was going to say, I've got the Blu-ray.
I have the DVD. I've owned it for years, and for some reason, I've never cracked it open.
It was one of the first
monster
when Criterion started doing Blu-rays.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I remember correctly.
I need to see it. I'm actually very deficient in my vendor's filmography. I've maybe seen two of his movies, and I've never seen The American
Friend. Which is amazing.
Which I really want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dennis Hopper.
Yeah. No, I need to see it. I need to see Wings of Desire. I will.
You let me borrow Tokyo Drifter.
Okay.
It'll be an even exchange.
But I want to borrow those other movies that you wrote about, too. By the time this one comes out, you will have written about two of them.
I almost included one of those. If you're listening to this on Wednesday, Valentine's Day, hopefully you read about this film yesterday.
Right.
And the film is Retaliation. And all I'm going to say is, it certainly contains one of the most unexpected off-the-wall love stories I've ever seen in 55 years of watching film, and I'm going to leave it at that. Hopefully you've read the column.
I have, so I know what's up. I think I really only have one more.
And I only have one more as
okay.
well.
Okay.
This is the one we're going to match.
Oh, no, we're not matching on this. This is my most out there pick.
Come on, we're going to match.
Is yours directed by Lucio Fulci?
No.
Then we are not going to match. Mine is really out there, and this is a movie that I've talked about a lot since it came out on Blu-ray for the first time last fall from Severin, and it's a film called The Devil's Honey, and it's a 1986 Fulci film that was sort of his comeback movie. He took a few years off because he had gotten very sick, and I would argue his last really good movie. And it's sort of, if you can imagine, an erotic thriller by way of Lucio Fulci. It's not a gore film.
Good.
But it's demented. this is spoiled by the film's Blu-ray cover art, especially if you bought the limited edition with the slip cover. But it essentially opens... it's about a couple, a woman and a man, and he's a musician. And the opening scene of the movie basically is the man bringing a woman to orgasm by playing his saxophone directly into her vagina. And it's like, well, that's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Okay, I'm going to go home.
And then it gets even weirder, and I won't say where it goes, but when you were talking about Secretary, I was actually thinking quite a bit about The Devil's Honey because it's about people with specific sort of psychosexual conditions and desires, and it's about finding other people who are like that and finding a way to sort of make it work. It's a lot darker than even Secretary, I would say. And it's a crazy movie, and it's not going to be for everyone, but I would argue that at its core, it's a movie about two people finding love with one another in a unique way.
And so at this point, Patrick feels he's won the game of unconventional romance and sex by bringing up saxophone sex, but he doesn't realize I have an ace in my pocket.
Damn it.
The final film we're going to talk All about right. on this podcast.
I thought for sure The Devil's Honey would.
No, I think at the very least it's a tie.
Okay.
But I think I win. My final unconventional Valentine's Day film.
Don't say Necromantic.
No, my God. Oh, my God. Necromantic. Anti-romantic. Is David Cronenberg's film Crash.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember when it came out, I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it way too much.
Yeah.
And I read an interview with him when he said what he wanted to do was look at love and sex, but using a metaphor that no one on earth
right.
would find sexy
right.
so that we could look at this phenomenon objectively. Then why do I find Crash sexy?
Well, because there are scenes of attractive movie stars kind of going at it with one
yes.
another.
So it's not like I'm sitting there, crash the car.
No.
There's a scene where Kara Unger tells this story to yeah. James Spader, and yeah. it's very erotic.
The hottest scene in the movie for me, I can't defend, so I probably shouldn't admit what it is.
Well, now you have to.
Well, it involves Rosanna Arquette.
Okay, and again, we don't want to engage in spoilers, but I thought, now that I've seen the film more than once, 50 times, to be honest, 50 times freed, that I thought Cronenberg was being disingenuous and not giving himself enough credit, because while that may have been his intent, his skill as a filmmaker enabled him to make a film about something that, again, no one in their right mind would mm-hmm. find sexy, but a lot of the film is sexy. And I think it has one of the greatest last lines, if not in Cronenberg's mm-hmm. oeuvre, but you know the line I'm talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about that line in terms of failed relationships.
Right.
And I don't want to give it away, but it's now been overshadowed by the other Crash, that won the Academy Award and that I got sick of defending years ago. And Patrick is shaking his head. Because
there are some good scenes in that movie.
He may have been right all along. And not to get off on a tangent, you know the main reason I like the Haggis crash.
The Matt Dillon stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we don't get to see that
right.
in a movie very right. often. And final tangent.
Okay.
And this is about all the movies that we're talking about. There was an article on Slate that my son brought to my attention. It's about a children's book called The Three Robbers. And The Three Robbers is a very strange children's book. I'll leave it at that. And the author was talking about his relationship to the book and how he'd loved to read it to his son and how his wife had refused to read the book to the son. The mother would say, if you want that as your bedtime book, go get dad because I'm not going to read it out loud because she was creeped out by it. And he relates this conversation he had with his son about whether the three robbers are good guys or bad guys because they do bad things and they do good things. And considering the age of the child, the conversation was fairly deep, and the child was saying, is the book saying that there's no bad guys? Well, maybe you're a bad guy when you do bad things, and you're a good guy when you do good things. So this whole idea of everything not being binary mm-hmm. and the fact that we want it to be that way, because mm-hmm. that makes it much easier for us to live our lives, mm-hmm. but not just like children's books. When I was making this list, I thought maybe we would all benefit if we didn't see love that way.
Yes.
And that we were sort of more accepting of all of its interpretations and permutations and that maybe it wasn't just one thing.
Well, think about in the history of movies how it has shaped what a lot of people think love is
yeah.
or should be. How we should be romanced, how relationships should progress. I mean, it has been codified through movies and now through shit like The Bachelor, right? But you bringing up Crash is interesting because besides revealing that you and I maybe have some weird fetishes because both of us are like, no, that movie's kind of hot, is that it is, like so many of the other movies that we're talking about I keep using the word broken, and that's not fair.
It's about the spaces in between the big things that we consider love.
Well, and it's about finding a person who shares your thing.
Yes.
Whether it's car crashes or whatever's going on in The Devil's Honey or a number of the movies that we talked about. It's about finding that other person, secretary, you know, it's about finding that other
Let
person.
The right one in.
Right,
it's,
right.
It's about finding another person because that's what's important. This isn't recent, of course, because I think social attitudes about some things have changed. But I could never understand people who were homophobic on religious grounds because that suggests that there's a God who's against love.
Right.
And I'm not particularly religious, but I could not imagine a God who, no.
But that was the argument.
Because love is one of the few things we have.
Right.
And I don't want to get too deep because it's Valentine's Day.
That's right.
And my heart-shaped pizza's getting cold. That's a euphemism.
Please remember that we have F This Movie Fest coming up on March 3rd. If you don't know about it, please visit fthismovie.com and click on the tab that says F This Movie Fest. It's March 3rd. It starts at noon central. We're going to be watching and tweeting about five movies from 1989. The lineup is UHF, Tango and Cash, The Burbs, Roadhouse, and we close it out with Batman. Which should be really fun. So we hope to get
big fun.
A lot of you joining us. Anybody who's done it before will tell you. It's a great time.
I'll be there. This final heart says TTYL.
Talk to you later.
And
which is a weird romantic thing to say to somebody. It's basically like fuck off, which is
right.
what my heart says.
But for a podcast,
yeah.
talk to you later
oh.
is pretty much perfect.
That is true.
Smooches. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.